Designers go off in all sorts of crazy flights of fancy. Engineers are enamored with technology and constraints. The CEO usually hasn't seen a deal he doesn't want to do. Marketing is happy to talk about things that are paper thin and don't actually have any utility or value underneath, right? And so the point is that product management can span all of these things and find the intersection of all these things. And to me, the metaphor is very simple. It's the director of the film. It's the conductor of the orchestra. Do you need an incredible director? Yes. Are there bad ones? Yes. Do they create shitty films? Yes. Does that mean the role is not important? No.
You're listening to the Startup Podcast. This is a Reacts episode. Industry insiders having frank debates about the latest tech, politics, and business news. Whether you're a founder, investor, or operator in a startup, you'll gain insights into how current events connect to broader themes and trends that impact your startup, your investments, and your day-to-day operational decisions. The conversation starts now.
Hi, I'm Yaniv Bernstein.
I'm Emil Michael.
And I'm Chris Saad. Welcome to another episode of the Startup Podcast Reacts. On today's show, we're going to talk about the tech landscape, how it's changed, what Emil's seeing in San Francisco and the Bay Area, and how should founders and investors think about the recent changes in the ecosystem. We're going to talk about tech hypocrisy as it relates to media, journalism, and the separation of church and state. How have Elon and Tim Apple ruined the world today? And we'll also cover SBF getting 25 years for his fraud over at FTX. And finally, we will touch on the future of product management. Do you even need product managers anymore? Maybe we should just fire all the product managers, starting with me. All that and more on this week's Startup Podcast Reacts. Stay tuned.
This episode of the Startup Podcast is brought to you by Vanta. You might know that sinking feeling. You're about to land a big contract when they ask about compliance, SOC 2, ISO, PCI, Essential 8. You've just snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. Not anymore. Vanta massively accelerates your compliance efforts and allows you to get those life-changing deals back on track. Don't wait until it's panic stations, though. Get started with Vanta today. They're offering 20% off their prices just for TSP listeners. Do yourself a favor. Hit pause, go to vanta.com/TSP, that's VANTA.com, to get that 20% off.
So the first thing we want to talk about is an update on the market, the investment climate out there, and how founders are responding. Emil, you are in Silicon Valley. You've been talking to founders. You've been seeing pitches. You've been deploying capital. You've been advising companies. And so give us a little bit of an update of what you're seeing out there and how our listeners should think and respond to the changing landscape.
I think what's just happening so much faster than the other boom cycles, mobile app store, internet, right now is like the amount of dollars going in sooner. Everyone's looking at the infrastructure layer, the chips layer, the power, the data, who's got proprietary data or not. What are the customer care applications? Like, it's starting to spread very widely, very fast, with lots of bubbly money chasing it. And lots of entrepreneurs shifting into like .AI. You know, we were all shocked at the OpenAI valuation. Now, like, there's dozens of companies raising hundreds of millions of dollars in every part of the ecosystem, taking their current business models, turning them around if they can to fit an AI world. And the infrastructure piece is becoming interesting again. Like, the $7 trillion number has caused, like, so many other people. I just met a company that was like, oh, we're building an NVIDIA competitor chip, and it's actually better today than theirs is. I don't know what's real, what isn't just yet, but, like, everything's coming out of the woodworks to sort of supply and take advantage of the AI sort of mania we've got right now.
One of the things you said, Emil, is you're not sure what's real and what isn't yet. And, you know, I think that for me is always the question. And what's your thesis going into this? You're like, you're looking at all these companies, you're trying to make some investment decisions, like, what feels the most real to you and what feels the most hyped?
The infrastructure side of this, the picks and shovels, feels very real, very, very real. Like, the things that enable compute and every component thereof seem very real. The things I'm not sure about, it's a continuation of our conversation from the last several weeks, is does the capability of the app ecosystem get sucked into the main system? And I actually think entrepreneurs are being smart about that because they're getting asked these questions in a lot of investor meetings. So they're saying, no, I'm going to go into a healthcare company. I'm going to be HIPAA compliant. I'm going to have all the customer data that can't leak into, you know, the mothership, but I'm going to use that capability to do better billing or to do, like, automated appeals to your health insurer. you know, things like that. And they're picking off niches where you're like, wow, I didn't think that was a big market. They're big markets, and they seem to be far enough away from sort of like the basic capability to be interesting in some way. So I'm a little more optimistic than I've been the last few weeks.
And is that affecting your own decisions?
Certainly, at least right now, affecting where I spend time. Mm. And then after time comes money and commitments. And, you know, I haven't gotten there yet.
So I guess one thing that, you know, I like to sort of draw the comparison, the contrast with crypto sometimes. It's what I'm hearing from you. And also, you know, what I'm seeing is crypto had a lot of hype. It had a bubble. It had a lot of money go into it. But it mostly stayed in its own lane, meaning there were crypto startups and there was everything else. And sure, a few people were like, hey, you know, we'll launch a coin or do an NFT, but it was kind of separate. Whereas it sounds like what you're seeing now is that every startup and therefore also every investor is looking to see how AI fits into their narrative. So it's sort of, it's broken out of containment and it's sort of everywhere now.
I'm feeling that. I mean, the problem with crypto was always it didn't have a clear set of use cases.
Yeah.
Right.
If you believe the crypto bros, it had every use case and you could rewrite everything on the blockchain. And the blockchain was a tool for every nail, right? And yeah, I mean, they believed in it, but you know.
But that was the classic case of starting with a solution, looking for a problem.
Right.
I think AI is inverted. It's like people are saying like, okay, this tech now exists. What problems can I solve with it? And people are trying to actually solve problems with this tech. So I feel like it's more real in that respect. And that doesn't mean not going to be a lot of losers and a lot of money's not going to get pissed away, but the world's going to change in fairly dramatic ways, you know, in lots of different dimensions, I feel, sooner rather than later.
So this sort of feels like a classic gold rush scenario, right? Where you've got all the infrastructure and then you've got thousands, tens of thousands, whatever, companies trying to make it big out of AI. And what we can predict is most of them will fail and some of them will hit it big and it's hard to tell which is which. And so then there's that classic investing strategy of picks and shovels, which is, yeah, down the stack where you're building the infrastructure. Everybody's going to need that. And that feels like a safer bet.
It feels like a safer bet, but that's not... We don't want everyone everywhere to be just building picks and shovels. Some people need to be mining for gold and some people need to be building the town and some people need to be, you know. And so, yeah, the safest bet in a gold rush is always the picks and shovels. And they're the ones that tend to walk away with guaranteed returns. But hopefully for the people listening to us who are outside of Silicon Valley, who are looking to invest their time, invest their energy, invest their cognitive efforts, there are safe bets, yes. But we would hope some of our audience would also be going for the big swing for the fences, you know, hit it out of the park type bets as well. And I think, Emil, you're seeing a lot of that. It's really exciting. And yeah, the question then comes down to how do you start to maximize your chances of success in the upper layers and the bigger bets? And how do you look for the right investments to make?
Emil, I had one other question for you before we move on from this, which is, are you seeing signs that there is starting to be an overinvestment in the AI space, meaning too much capital chasing too little talent or too few businesses? Or are you still seeing that there's sort of value here and some sort of balance?
There's way more money chasing a smaller number of good ideas, for sure, which is the definition of a bubble, gold rush, whatever you want to call it, where like there's a few good ideas, a lot of money chasing them. And then what happens is people look for the next best idea. And then the next, like the money is like water flowing downhill. It searches for the holes it could like sink into. But again, I think that's just the nature of the business. As entrepreneurs and company builders, this is good for us.
I agree. But I mean, it's funny, ever since the sort of 2021 bubble burst, and there was a kind of a VC winter, you know, we've talked about, you know, there's quite a lot of money sitting on the sidelines, quite a lot of dry powder, a lot of big funds that hadn't allocated. And it just seems like all that capital is in play now. And so we've got quite a bit of whiplash, right? Where we've gone from crazy 2021 hype to a sort of 2022, 2023 winter. And now we're back, but with a very strong AI flavor. And the stats are showing it as well, by the way, like deployment VC investments are way up compared to the previous quarter.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we can quibble about the exact timing, but I think we predicted this a little bit, Yanev, on the show way back when, right? This idea that, hey, that the world has not collapsed. The game has not completely changed. The rules have tightened a little bit. They will loosen once interest rates change and the next era begins. And it just seemed like everybody was completely despondent and in despair. And it's like, it'll never be the same again. And I think you and I were counseling that, hey, guys, chill out a little bit. These ebbs and flows happen pretty regularly.
Absolutely.
All right. The next topic we want to discuss is the changing media landscape. You know, historically, guys, large media companies have been owned by these big media conglomerates, right? You can think about CNN and Time Warner and Sony and what have you. They've attempted to maintain this kind of church and state separation where editorials over here and the commercials and sponsorships and ads are over there. And that's changing, right? These days, large tech companies are becoming serious media companies. Of course, there's Netflix, which is kind of a pure media play. But Apple has got Apple TV Plus, and X is sort of pseudo-represented by or affiliated by Tesla and SpaceX, right? Through Elon Musk. And these guys are trying to be media companies. You know, Elon recruited Don Lemon over from CNN, well, after he got fired from CNN. And Jon Stewart from The Daily Show moved over to Apple. But these companies have very different principles and ethics. At least they're grappling with them. Musk had an interview with Don Lemon and fired him before the first show aired. Apple lost Jon Stewart, or Jon Stewart and Apple parted ways. We didn't quite know why. And just recently on The Daily Show, he revealed that part of it was they didn't want him to interview the FTC chair, Lina Khan, about Apple's potential monopolistic behaviors. And they didn't want him to talk about the AI revolution disrupting the economy. And recently, you know, Elon Musk has been suing people who are saying stuff about X that he doesn't like. So how do we think about this change, and how do we think about this hypocrisy, and how do we think about this culture shift in media where our brethren, the tech execs and tech companies, are becoming media moguls, and the changing kind of ethics and discourse that might arise out of that?
Yaniv always sets the outer pole of this discussion. So,
oh, geez. Okay. Look, I mean, first of all, this is not totally new. It's more of a like everything old is new again, right? Like I think what's actually historically been true in media is it has been controlled by wealthy people who are at least in part trying to push a certain agenda, right? And I think, you know, the newspapers and media companies did develop a certain immune system. Like you said, there's a certain amount of editorial independence and so on, but newspapers were and still are known as having a particular political bent that generally suits that of their owner. I think, you know, publicly listed media companies is actually a bit of a newer phenomenon, but media has always been, I guess, in a bit of a complex situation with regards its ownership, right? Because it's a public good, but it's generally privately held. That's why a number of countries such as the UK and Australia have a public broadcaster to try, you know, one can argue how successfully, to try to present a more balanced or neutral point of view. But news and politics and news and money have always been tangled up together. And so actually Elon Musk is more like, if you look at him, he's more like a, you know, William Randolph Hearst or some like old school media mogul than anything particularly new here. I just think, and I welcome it in this discussion, the recognition that the big tech companies are media companies. Like that's why we're talking about, you know, banning TikTok and so on. These are media companies. They have editorial influence. And yes, they need to be thought about in that way.
I love it. That's what I wanted. I wanted the Elon Musk.
Okay. All right. Off you go. Off you go, then.
You gave it to me.
I'm a generous man.
I would say the following. Yes, these tech companies that were protected by Section 230 that said they were neutral to content are not neutral to content. YouTube says, do this, don't do that. Twitter, before it was X, was like, you may not publish this New York Post article. You may not say Hunter Biden laptop, you know, whatever. It was deciding what we saw or not. The thing I think you're missing on it is that not only now are there more communication channels, and there's some bad sides to that, no doubt. People can get information lots of different ways. So there's no longer three TV networks that have to be neutral or else the influence they have is so dramatic that you had to have regulation. Now there's like infinite channels and we have, it's sort of entropy. It's like everywhere. So I don't know that you could put that genie back in the bottle. And I would argue that X among all these big tech companies is the most neutral. It has the least content point of view sort of pushing on you. If you want to follow like your lefty followers or your righty followers, you could do either, but they all exist there. And I think YouTube and some of these other platforms absolutely do not have all the points of view for business reasons.
Okay. So first of all, yeah, I mean, I don't want this to become a conversation about like, you know, the political leanings of one platform or another. I know I gave you Elon, but I guess my point is more, you know, in terms of his being a mogul, but I actually think the interesting point to debate or discuss, Emil, is what you were saying earlier, which is you said there are so many channels now, there are infinite channels. And in some sense, you're completely correct, right? Like, there are so many YouTube channels, there are so many creators publishing everywhere, right? And you can say, compared to the old era of three broadcast networks, then of course the influence of any one channel is diffuse. But the question is the channel the right place to be talking about it now, or do we actually move up to the algorithm, which is what we've discussed in previous points, right? It's like, you've got lots of channels, but you've only got a small number of platforms, and each of those platforms exert a type of editorial control by the algorithmic choices they're making. And exactly to your point, Emil, like, you know, again, I don't want to make this a left versus right thing or whatever, but you can say YouTube has an algorithm that favors certain types of content. TikTok has an algorithm that favors certain types of content. And there are only a handful of these platforms that are truly influential, and they reach more people than even the major US TV networks did in their glory days.
For me, this topic is a lot less about the algorithm and their ability to curate or amplify UGC, let's say, versus these large tech companies getting in the business of highly polished, produced, funded content that itself has an editorial bent or slant that is overt. So, you know, Yanev, you talked about, well, it's always been so, the media barons have always had a political agenda and what have you. And of course, that's true, but there's been a march towards editorial independence, towards principles and journalistic ethics, towards at least attempted reductions in bias. And while it has never been perfect, it's been an aspiration to separate the commercial interests or the owner's interests from the editorial choices. Mm. And you know, you mentioned Hunter Biden's laptop. At least the premise is that that's an editorial judgment about what is good for democracy versus a political or commercial judgment. Now, I'm not saying that's actually true. I'm saying at least there was a veil of that's what the premise was. But now these tech companies are exerting overt, commercially motivated editorial control. And then independent creators have no semblance of trying to be unbiased. Bias is the name of the game. Like, it's how biased, how personality driven can they be? And so I do think this is a reversion away from something that we were trying to work towards, or seemed that we were trying to work towards. And I think it is problematic. And, you know, and then just lastly on Elon and X, I really think this is just a narrative, like this idea that I'm all about free speech. I think he's really revealed himself that this narrative is full of shit, which makes me wonder if his other narratives about, you know, SpaceX and Tesla are full of shit, because he claims he wants to support and endorse free speech, and yet he's suing researchers who are revealing hate speech and the nature and type and tenor of the conversation on his platform. He's suing them into silence. It's called a slap case, right? To silence dissent. One interview with Don Lemon that he doesn't like, and he shuts down his funding and his amplification. That's not an advocate for free speech. That's not a philosophically pure stance. That's hypocrisy. And I think he believes it, or he espouses it when it suits his commercial narrative, and then overtly shuts it down. I think it's extremely, it's shocking how lacking in self-awareness he has about this, and how some of his advocates continue to repeat his narrative about this. I think it's not, it doesn't have any substance.
I mean, okay, in an attempt to not have this be focused on Elon, the narrative of SpaceX is they're freaking rockets flying into the air and satellites. No narrative. It's like, actually,
no,
is.
I'm talking about each of his companies seem to have this civilization changing narrative. Like, Tesla is about climate change, and SpaceX is about creating a backup planet, and X is about free speech. And he like wraps himself in this cloak of, I am saving humanity. And I believe that. And I believed and believe, whether it's true or not in his heart of hearts, that he is doing things that are fundamentally good for humanity. But with Twitter, he is revealing hypocrisy in that mission that calls into question his altruistic missions in the other categories. He's clearly achieving results, but I'm talking about intent, and I'm really more talking about the media side of things.
All right, let me put myself in the unusual position of more or less defending Elon Musk here. Here's my view. I think that he has these various companies with altruistic and ambitious and world-changing ambitions, and a lot of them have had immense positive impact, and I believe he is doing those things for those reasons. I also think, as are we all, he is a flawed human being. He's very intense. I think he's got a fragile ego, and I think that Sometimes, yes, it is hypocrisy, I suppose. When it gets too close to him, Elon Musk, and his ego, his principles can get a bit compromised. There's like a lot of heat coming off it, and that shit gets singed, right? Like, if you go into Elon Musk's free speech platform and you say a bit too publicly, Elon Musk is a fucking douchebag or whatever, then, you know, at some point, he's probably going to stop paying you, at least, right? So it's like, okay, yeah, maybe that's compromising his principles, but I don't think... Chris, I think you're drawing too long a bow to say it calls everything into questions. Like, it's his ego. It doesn't mean that, like, the bigger picture is different.
I don't think it matters, right? The topic is...
Well, you brought it up.
No, I brought it up. It's perhaps a distraction. The topic is really that I feel like there is a receding of the aspiration for editorial independence, journalistic integrity. And the question really is, Elon demonstrated that on X to some degree. Apple and Apple TV Plus and what have you have demonstrated that to some degree. And the independent creators on YouTube or what have you who are leaning into cults of personality and bias are demonstrating this as well.
But Chris, here's the thing, is the obligation that you're talking about was for journalists. It wasn't meant to be for media companies. Journalists and publications stopped being trusted and respected. They lost that trust.
Agreed.
That was their issue. So then the content providers who never like pretended to be in the business of neutrality, they're not acting like it, but they never promised the world, right? Apple TV never promised the world they were going to have some balanced viewing thing. Let's take X aside for a second. YouTube never told the world we were going to be balanced or whatever. So
I 100% agree with you on both fronts. The first is the quote unquote mainstream media or traditional media abdicated their responsibility and revealed themselves to be failing in the face of their responsibilities, right? So for me, that occurred during the build-up to the Iraq War. I saw them being cheerleaders for something that was clearly wrong, and it kind of revealed that they didn't really have everyone's best interest at heart. And I also agree with you that these tech companies who are becoming major media companies have not promised us that they can replace or have any aspiration to do this kind of journalism. Which leaves us back at the topic, which is, where does this leave democracy, where democracy leans on a well-informed citizenry powered by an effective media engine providing real facts and information? Where does that leave us?
Okay, so let me draw a through line back to, I think we were discussing this just last week, right? Which was the antitrust case against Apple. And what I was saying last time, which is like the broader principle around antitrust, is that whether a business got to a position of immense power, rightly or wrongly, let's assume they did everything squeaky clean, it is nonetheless, it becomes problematic for a functioning democracy if a single corporation holds too much power. With antitrust, you're basically saying the bigger you are, the more you will be regulated, the more rules you have to play by that are not the normal rules of business. They are stricter rules. Because you are so big and so powerful that if you don't follow those rules, it is dangerous. And if you're not able to follow those rules, then the ultimate remedy is we break you up and then you're not so big anymore, right? And so I think this is just part of the same thing. We have a small number of companies. I think they used to be called FANG. They seem to be called the Magnificent Seven these days. A small number of companies have accrued such vast power. You know, it was only a few years ago that there had never been a $1 trillion publicly listed company. Now we've got, what, like four? And they're all big tech companies. It's an unprecedented accrual of power, and accruing power is not bad in itself, but you know, it has externalities. When you're that big and that powerful, you can break things by accident because you're just the big fucking elephant sitting on a mouse. And that's what I see here.
And here's the counter that I've thought about since our last episode is that, like, fine, if you break up all these companies, the thing that still remains unsolved is that you have a fractured populace in all democratized nations, getting their information from many different sources that we can't possibly control. And so, yes, you could break up some of the big ones, but Rumble still exists. And like all these other things still exist that back to, and this comes back to your algorithm argument, Yaniv, which is the algorithms are designed for provocation and addiction. And whoever does that is going to win. Whoever does the addiction thing the best is going to win. I don't know that breaking up these companies sort of changes that. Whoever still has the algorithm, whatever entity it goes to, is still going to be like doing its thing. And I don't have a solve. I mean, this is the sad part. What's the solve? I don't fucking know, man. Excuse my language.
I don't have a solve either.
No, I don't know that we can figure out the solve in, you know, in an hour podcast, but it does strike me as surprising the lack of self-awareness, long-range thinking, and ethical integrity of some of these people who are in charge of these companies. I expected more from Apple than
what, what's your Apple issue? What is the example?
The example for Apple, I should have maybe set it up more clearly, is that they basically fired John Stewart, or they came to creative differences. John Stewart is, you know, one of the commentators of our time, because they didn't want him to speak about the potential disruption about AI, and they didn't want him to interview the FTC chair, because those are against their commercial interests. And it's surprising to me that, I don't know why I keep wanting to call him Tim Apple just for fun, that Tim Apple would allow that kind of short-sighted editorial oversight over a John Stewart. It's not surprising to me lately, but the historical Elon, it's surprising to me that he would be so overtly hypocritical. And I expected more from tech leaders, perhaps naively, than I did from the oil barons and the media barons of days of yore. That, yeah, I just expected more.
It's naive. But look, on Apple, on Apple, I'm 0% surprised. I'm surprised that you're surprised, in fact, because it is classic Apple. And, you know, again, we were talking about it just last week in the context of the App Store and all these like antitrust cases. Apple is a walled garden. Apple controls what is on its platform, always has. That is the value that they offer. And, you know, you guys were actually taking the other side of the debate last week, saying, you know, of course, you know, if you buy into Apple, that's what you get. So what's the problem? And again, the problem is only one thing. Apple is really, really big. So I'm kind of glad in a way that we've come to this point, because I think that is the core issue here. It is not their fault. In fact, they should be commended for getting so big. But it is nonetheless a problem, because anything that they do has outsized consequences.
But who cares? John Stewart is a name brand. He could go...
Chris cares.
But he gets to go talk about whatever he wants to talk about so many other places.
I think the idea that Apple curates its technology ecosystem is somewhat orthogonal to Apple exercising editorial control over a Jon Stewart news program.
They're somewhat different.
But this is the point. It's in their DNA, Chris. It's in their DNA. That's what they do.
What I, again, talking about narrative and stated goals, you know, Tim Cook's DNA is liberalism. And in standing up for people who are low in power dynamics, right? They wrap themselves in the pride flag, for example. They're the first to talk about vaccinations and masking, and they are hyper-liberal and hyper-pro-freedom and democracy, and in terms of the civilization, not their ecosystem. And it strikes me as surprising that he would take his liberal values and say John Stewart can't talk about work disruptions and labor disruptions and can't talk about the FTC, talk to the FTC chair. That is surprising to me. And I think it's overtly hypocritical. I think it's overtly hypocritical.
Is that verified, that like the FTC thing? Because that's more concerning to me than the AI thing. Like the fact that you can't have a government official who's appointed and approved by the Senate,
I mean, it's
speak on a news show.
It was a throwaway line by Jon Stewart in the last Monday morning show that he did, because he's back on The Daily Show, where he did the AI segment and then he had the FTC chair on. And he just said, and by the way, Apple didn't want us to do that AI segment and didn't want me to interview you. And that's part of, you know, basically that's part of the reason we parted ways, is what he alluded to.
I got to tell you, I wanted to have you on a podcast, and Apple asked us not to do it. To have you. They literally said, please don't talk to her. Having nothing to do with what you do for a living. I think they just... I didn't think they cared for you is what happened. they wouldn't let us do even that dumb thing we just did in the first act on AI. Like, what is that sensitivity? Why are they so afraid to even have these conversations out in the public sphere?
And so, yeah, it was, anyway, you're surprised by my surprise. I'm surprised. And I'm disappointed. I'm disappointed in Tim Apple.
You're sad.
I'm sad. Now this is the Happy, Sad, Confused podcast. But it does leave me wondering, where are the independent journalistic voices that are funded by serious companies? And where does this leave democracy long term? That does concern me.
This episode of the Startup Podcast is brought to you by Vanta. The team at Vanta are passionate about helping you secure your business by vastly cutting down on the time to get compliant with frameworks like ISO 27001, SOC 2, and Essential 8. Vanta lets you close deals, sleep better at night, and get back to building your product. Help yourself and help the podcast by going to vanta.com/TSP for an exclusive 20% off deal.
All right, let's switch subjects. So one of the other topics we wanted to discuss just quickly is SBF has been sentenced to 25 years in jail for his alleged, I guess it's not alleged anymore, his proven fraud in FTX and other ventures. What do you guys think about this whole story? You know, FTX, him being charged, and now him being sentenced to 25 years.
So, you know, interesting story. His mother, Barbara Fried, was a professor of mine in law school. And I was like, I had the best relationship. I've known her from 1995 to 1998. I was there, and I was like one of her favorite students because I had a counter view in a place like Stanford. And she was my favorite professor. I kept in touch with her for years. So, sorry, a little sad and ironic that this happened. But I mean, everything I've read, and I've read a lot, and I've read it with the legal hat on, is like, yeah, there was fraud. There's a lot of money lost, even though Bitcoin prices came back and hopefully people get their money back. I mean, this is sort of some fraud and 25 years in jail. Maybe it gets down to 18 of good behavior. I don't look at this and say anything was very wrong that happened to this guy, given what happened to the public and what could have happened.
Just to be clear, when you say you don't think anything happened wrong, you mean you think his being charged and his being convicted and sentenced to 25?
To be clear, I thought it was real fraud. There are real consequences for real fraud, and he is going to suffer that consequences. And so far, all of it seems to have been in the interests of justice.
Yep. Look, I'm inclined to agree. I think, let me just sort of briefly encapsulate the arguments on each side of, you know, whether this is how harshly he should be punished, right? So first of all, on the side of, you know, he had it coming, is this was real fraud on a grand scale, and he has shown no remorse and, you know, in fact, has continued to try to kind of undermine the course of justice, right? He was not cooperative. Now, on the other side, I think that, you know, there's two things that are quite telling. One is, in the end, as it happens, mostly thanks to SBF's, or rather FTX's shareholding in Anthropic AI, nobody lost any money, which is fascinating. So all the creditors were made whole. And then the other thing is, I think there's a more general view that some people hold, is that white collar crime just isn't such a serious crime compared to, like, you know, murder or things like that. So I think, you know, as with a lot of things, it can come down a little bit to ideology, but I think there's enough evidence out there now that Sam Bankman-Fried is a dishonest person who knew what he was doing. And this wasn't just a little bit of, like, youthful hijinks. It was fraud on a grand scale, and he thought he would get away with it, and he didn't get away with it. And, you know, that's pretty much what it came down to. And 25 years seems reasonable for that. There's this other thing I wanted to talk about, which is the last couple of months has actually been a really interesting time in terms of the discussion of product management as a function. And I think possibly the place where it started was when Brian Chesky, founder and CEO of Airbnb, announced that they wouldn't have dedicated product managers at Airbnb anymore. So I think that was sort of one notable point. Then the other is Marty Kagan, who we've actually had on this show, is arguably the leading thinker and writer on the topic of product and product management today. He started a series of blog posts, and a main one was called Product Management Theater, in which he argued that so many companies and so many product managers are actually calling themselves product managers, and they're adopting all these rituals and so on, but they're not really being product managers. They're really being project managers, and all of this other stuff they do to make themselves feel like product managers, to justify the title, to justify the status and the higher salary, is just a kind of theater, right? And not really product management. Then there are, you know, people kind of arguing back against him. And again, John Cutler, who we also had on the show, was kind of saying this is a too narrow a view of what product management is. And zooming out on all this, what's fascinating to me is that as a tech industry that is focused primarily on building products and products that scale, and we have this role called product management, which is supposed to be at the very core of what it is to build a product, there is basically zero agreement about what the role actually involves and whether it's even necessary to have an independent role. And I think this is fascinating. I also think it is significant because, in my view, an inability to efficiently build valuable products is one of the things that makes tech less capital efficient than it could be. And I know, Chris, obviously you make a business out of trying to help people with that. So I feel like there's a moment here that is actually consequential.
Yeah, look, with Brian, you know, there are exceptions to every rule. I don't think we can take one company, one person who happens to be a strong product thinker and say, hey, every company could run like this. But I find most product management principles or orthodoxy to be full of shit. you know, experimenting your way to everything, iterating your way to nowhere. And the idea that most product managers are actually project managers is one that I've actually written about multiple times over the last years. Most product managers are actually project managers. I've written the same thing. Or business analysts. They gather requirements from other people. They manage the chaos. They turn it into a managed process, and they pump features out the other side. And I've been railing against this for years, and I'm glad that it's been popularized by others today. Real product management for me is invaluable. It's priceless. And it's not about managing requirements. It's not about experiments. It's not about iterating your way to nowhere. It's about being the director of a film. It's about being the conductor of the orchestra. It's about having a vision, having principles, having taste, having intuition, and about creating new consensus, not just finding the Venn diagram overlap of what everyone else would like. And I see very, very, very few people who act that way. And then just finally, you're talking about people pushing back on Marty Kagan saying, you know, you're drawing too narrow a view. Yeah, everybody loves to accuse others of gatekeeping, of being too opinionated. I'm a shining example of someone who likes to define things very precisely and can be accused of gatekeeping. I don't think it's gatekeeping. I think it's clarifying and being specific about what things mean. And product management means something very specific. It's about building things that matter and driving that, driving it all the way through. And I've fundamentally learned this at Uber. I saw some incredible product managers, including Yuki, who is now, I think, head of product at Figma, who literally, using these words, motivated and animated the entire company, rallied them around what we called Project Helix, redesigning the entire Rider app in just with incredible vision and vigor and clarity of thinking that you can't do without someone standing up there on stage motivating the outcome. And that's a product manager.
But Chris, isn't that something very, very wrong here when we have this whole function of product management and it is so rarely done well or even adequately by the majority of people who call themselves product managers? This is sort of the illness that's being spoken about. And when I reflect on my history of working with product managers, I can count on the fingers of one hand those who I felt were really doing that incredible job. By the way, including Clementine Jacoby, who we had on the show last week. I wonder if it's like, if you only have such a, this is a new thought to me, but if you only have such a small number of really great product managers, is the problem that all the other product managers are bad? Or is the problem the product management role and that the great ones are succeeding despite the role because they are so good at what they do? And that's actually the secret sauce. Like, is it replicable?
Well, I mean, you could say that about many functions, right? I think most CEOs are bad at their job. I think most CMOs are bad at their job. I think most VCs are bad at their job. I think the level of incompetence in the world is really all too high. And yeah, product management is not immune from that at all. And I agree with you. I think great product managers are rare, the same way great directors are rare. The great producers are rare. Great CEOs are rare. If you have a great product manager, you need to hold on to them for dear life. It just makes them more valuable, not less. Does that mean the other product managers are bad? I think they've been trained badly or they've taken the wrong lessons from the books. And more often, they're in bad companies. Companies that claim to be product-led, but are actually sales-led or CEO-led or marketing-led or engineering-led or science-led. And they're not given the space and the freedom to actually lead. I'm right now advising a company that's publicly listed. And our ambition, I'll take credit for this, the ambition that I've given them is to be one of the best product-led companies in the country. And that's not going to be hard because there are so few companies in the country, and I won't even say which country, who claim to be product-led. They are not product-led. And just exceeding that bar, I think, will make this company massively differentiated and successful in a way that other companies in its category and in its country will not achieve.
I mean, as primarily a business person, I think one of the worst things that happened to the product management function was to allow Harvard Business School graduates to have it. Meaning, like, in my career, the best I've ever worked with have always been former engineers. They understood the possibilities of what the tech could do, not in theory, but in practice. And therefore, they were grounded in the magic of software, to use a Bill Gates term. And a vision, I do agree with this like notion of a vision, a director of a film concept. There's sort of a wow factor. If you look at what the features like a Tesla releases over time, you're like, wow, I didn't even think of that. Like, it's so interesting that they're doing this crazy de-icing thing, or they're doing these things you never thought you needed. And like, there's some product manager in there playing that function who's ahead of us. He's ahead of the world. He or she is ahead of the world. And that is magic. And I don't know how to detect it. You guys probably have better instincts on it, but like the product managers I've worked with, who business school graduates who went into it because they could build a spreadsheet and do the analysis and see what the TAM was on this or that, were just the hardest to ever get great productivity out of.
I guess what I'm trying to highlight here, I'm inclined to agree. And again, Marty Kagan also says, you know, and he's an ex-engineer. I think that, you know, ex-engineers often make the best product managers. And at Google, I don't know if this is still the case, but certainly back in the day, product managers are expected to have strong technical skill, you know, engineering background, or at least be engineering adjacent and really understand how that stuff works. So I agree with that. But like, I do think it's a function that's in crisis in the sense that it's having an identity crisis. And okay, let's talk about the Brian Chesky thing, because I think what's interesting here is not what he said, but the reaction to it, right? He was like, we don't have product managers anymore. And there's actually a whole lot of nuance into what they actually do now. But what was interesting is everyone's like, ah, Airbnb doesn't have product managers anymore. I knew it. I knew product managers were useless. Now we can get rid of product managers at my company, right? And so the problem is, if you don't have good product management in your company, if you're not product led, and then you have people whose title is product manager, you quickly get to the point of wondering, what exactly do these people do? And then that endangers the actual function everywhere, right? And so I do think it's problematic. And, you know, Chris, like, yes, you know, there's the old Sturgeon's law, right? 90% of anything is crap. So yes, it's true. Like, you know, there's a lot of bad CEOs, a lot of bad CMOs and so on. But if you look at, say, engineering or design, there's at least a clear responsibility that falls within that remit. And I think all too often with product management, because it kind of sits in the middle, if it's not doing the things that product management is really critical for, then it can start to feel like unnecessary overhead. And that's where you move further away from a product-led world.
Yeah, I suspect, I haven't looked into this deeply, but I suspect Marty Kagan and Brian Chesky are saying two different things. They're not actually aligned with each other. And
they are saying different things. They're both creating a sense of crisis, I think, in the profession.
Yeah, they're calling into question because people love to read headlines and just generalize. But like, I think Marty is saying product managers can and should be better.
Mm-hmm.
They should aspire to be creative forces with taste and vision and intuition and drive things forward. Brian is saying, I don't need all that noise. I can dictate the product direction of Airbnb because I'm just brilliant.
Actually, that's mostly not what Brian was saying.
Well, he was saying they weren't adding value and that there should be some kind of centralized orchestration, right?
Well, that was part of what he was saying. But actually, if you look at what he said, is they've merged the product management function with the product marketing function. And I think that's really interesting, right? Like, one of the things that I think is somewhat relatively new in tech, and I do think is a double-edged sword, is the emergence of a distinct product manager role, as opposed to the product management work being owned by some combination of other roles within the team, right? So product management touches marketing, it touches design, it touches engineering, it touches the business and so on. And like, if you look at the old days of like, not even the old days, but if you look at, say, CPG companies and, you know, what product management used to be like in the old days, is it was a function that was owned by marketing. And then when I look at software, I mean, this, maybe I'm going to take this down a bit of a tangent, which we may or may not want to keep. But like, I think also about the role of design, of product designers. And I feel like quite often designers are quite disempowered. They end up in a situation where they're basically left putting lipstick on a pig, right? They're just trying to make the thing look nice, because all of the actual design in the broad sense, not the make it look pretty, but the design is being owned by the product manager. And so I actually have seen, and I'm sort of intrigued by, a world where designers are actually owning a lot of what is called product management, right? Talking to customers, thinking through how it should work and so on. Because I think what product management often does, it actually constrains what design is able to do.
Yeah, but that's the point, right?
Is it?
Because designers go off in all sorts of crazy flights of fancy. Engineers are enamored with technology and constraints. The CEO usually hasn't seen a deal he doesn't want to do. Marketing is happy to talk about things that are paper thin and don't actually have any utility or value underneath, right? And so the point is that product management can span all of these things and find the intersection of all these things. And to me, the metaphor is very simple. It's very simple. It's the director of the film. It's the conductor of the orchestra. You take that conductor out. You take the director out, the whole thing falls apart. Do you need an incredible director? Yes. Do you need a good conductor? Yes. Are there bad ones? Yes. Do they create shitty films? Yes. Does that mean the role is not important? No. It's just, it's very simple. And, you know, can a producer manhandle the directing of the film and make it a bit better? Yes. Can the set decorator and costume designer make a film a bit better? Yes. Can the builders and technicians of the sets and the electronics, like, can they make it better? Yes. But if there isn't a unified vision that says that costume needs to be red because the background is blue and the whole thing needs to be this color palette because I want people to feel sad here because we're going to make them laugh in the next scene, and the overall theme is, you know, loss and grief, you just have a bunch of really smart, creative, technically competent people producing a spaghetti mess, and the audience is left wondering, what the fuck was that all about? You need someone to do the product management, even if it's the CEO, as the case of Airbnb.
Emil, I'll let you have the last word. You're making lots of interesting faces.
I just think, like, I think these things are so niche-y. Like, okay, what could have happened to Airbnb? Let me speculate. Brian looks across the organization. He's like, fuck, there's a lot of people who are not being great product managers. So I'm going to get rid of product management.
Yeah.
And it was sort of a more reorganization. And you know how this life cycle of companies. Companies are verticalized, like marketing, sales, engineering, whatever. And then they become business units like 10 years later. And then they break down the business units and go functional. It's sort of like a normal cyclical distaste for whatever's not working at the moment, and they need to shake an org up and whatever. But the core need for a tech company to do what Chris is saying, whatever you call it, product marketing, you could call it product marketing. You could call it whatever you want. The need to put the pieces together and anticipate what innovation is possible and is going to be delightful and profitable. Delightful for consumers, profitable for the company, is a mixture of skill sets that is magic when you find it. You could call it janitor, CEO, head of product management, head of growth, CMO. Yeah, there's a thousand things you could call it. Like a Procter & Gamble, there is a CEO of Clorox who sells bleach. That person owns the P&L, and he owns the package size, he or she, package size and whatever. And every year, like, there's a scoreboard and how he or she is doing.
I think that's the most important thing, Emil, you just said, which is, like, we take these examples, like Brian at Airbnb, and go, oh my God, it's a new pattern. Let's everybody chase that ball. And it's this, like, brain fart from this guy who decided to do a reorg and is, like, overly public about what he's done.
I agree, but I think you guys are missing the point. I don't care what Brian Chesky said. I care how the world has reacted to that. Okay, the world's a bit grand, but like the world of product management and the world of people who pay product managers are like, ah, oh, yeah, you know, the number of CEOs I've spoken to are like, yeah, I always wondered what that person did. And then Brian Chesky's giving them air cover, right? Like that is the problem. It is not an appreciated or understood role. It's not a well-defined role. And I think that's a problem.
I think it is a problem. And I think you're right. There are a lot of bad people in the role, or people who are bad at the role, I should say. And you're right. It's giving them air cover. And the companies who choose to take that air cover instead of looking at how to improve their org are going to falter and fail even faster than they were before. The reality is you need product managers. You need great product managers, and you need a great org that empowers the product managers. And if you're thinking otherwise, as Emil said, you can call them whatever the hell you want to call them. And if you're thinking otherwise, you're just going to accelerate your failure. I agree with your premise, Yanev, that product management as a function needs to do a better job of defining itself and educating itself and building principles for itself.
It's just something different at every company. It's different and it changes by the life cycle of the company. It just does. Like, and I think Brian's a great CEO and he may believe what he says, but I think if you rewind 8 years on Airbnb, whoever did the first product that he thought was brilliant, he probably said, like, product managers are great. And, like, now times have changed and his org and his business have changed so that, like, whatever he was doing, he doesn't like anymore. And I do agree with you, Chris. If entrepreneurs are taking too much weight on that to reorganize, then they're weak. And I want to, if there was a short index against those CEOs, I would buy that short index.
I think if you're a CEO sitting there going, hey, yeah, maybe I should fire my product managers because they're crap, you're probably the crap CEO. And so it's just like, how about you go figure out how to build a real product-led org and organize your team and hire better people and actually execute? Okay, guys, let's wrap this up. Emil, how can people find you on the internet?
I'm Emil Michael, and you can find me on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Emil Michael.
And Yanev?
I am mostly on LinkedIn, but yes, I am also on X, soon to be known once more as Twitter, at Y Bernstein. You can find me there. And also my new fundraising coaching business, fundingfit.co. Chris, how about you?
I'm very excited that you've launched that thing, Yaniv. You can follow me on all the social media at ChrisSard or chrisard.com/newsletter.
Also, goddamn, making a podcast is hard work. If you listen to the Startup Podcast, you've implicitly signed up to the Startup Podcast Pact, which means in return for all of this amazing value we give you, we ask you just a couple of really small things. We'd like you to follow and rate us in your listening app, subscribe on YouTube, and give us a shout out on LinkedIn or wherever you have your audience. It helps us grow the podcast, it helps us stay motivated, and help more founders, which is really the main reason that we do this in the first place.
All right, awesome. Were we actually recording this whole time?
This episode of the Startup Podcast was brought to you by Vanta. Vanta helps businesses get and stay compliant by automating up to 90% of the work for the most in-demand compliance frameworks. With over 200 integrations, you can easily monitor and secure the tools your business relies on. Head to vanta.com/TSP for 20% off their incredible offering and start unlocking extra revenue today.